Welcome back from the Easter break. Hopefully everybody's rested and ready to go. The time is 10:15, April 18th, and for the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Holmes, Representative Kelly, myself, Co-Chair Meyer, Vice Chair Stoltz, and Representative Warwick. On this morning's schedule, we have the following bills. House Bill 426, Medical Assistance for Persons Under Age 21. Representative Coghill is here to present that. As well as House Bill 500, Bonding Authority for Hatcher Pass, and House Bill 496. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, apologize, there's no donuts today. Nobody's cell phone's been going off. So if somebody wants to give me their cell phone number and leave their cell phone on and bring us donuts this afternoon, that would be fine. Okay, with that, Representative Coghill, if you want to tell us what House Bill 426 is all about. Looks like Ms. Moss is with you. Welcome to House Finance.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 426 started with a discussion of how do we tighten up some of our Medicaid eligibility issues so that those who have the greatest need get it and those who can pay their way do. And that was the first question I began to ask the people who did Medicaid law in Alaska and had to manage the Medicaid billing and systems. So that started the journey on this. Now, last year I did House Bill 53, which if you remember correctly, I took over some of the governor's bills and incorporated several other legislators. Well, this is happening to me, and under this bill, I have I've been hijacked by the governor's office on this one, but I'm in agreement with it. So it's been a work in progress, and so I'm going to let them explain some of these. But I wanted to explain to you the general philosophy that I had, and that is, with the rising cost of Medicaid, we're not going to be able to just keep doing things the way we've been doing it. We're going to have to say to those who can take care of themselves through third-party payers, other insurance groups, that they can and should, that if they are going to get other benefits from the state, like the permanent fund dividend, and can't pay their medical costs, then that will have to go towards that. So that's what's going to happen under this bill, should you approve it the way it is. There is a couple of amendments. The federal government has got the Budget Deficit Reduction Act, which targets a lot of Medicaid issues. Wow. And you're going to be seeing some of that brought before you today in this law on our subrogation issues. So how we respond to the federal government in their budget deficit reduction. So the pressure's on under our safety net system to make sure that it's truly a safety net and that it's not enabling people to hide assets, to misuse the system, or to take a benefit that they could really afford to take on their own nickel, so that other people who don't have that extra money can actually get the safety net help. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I have a whole group of people here, including my staff, Reneva Moss, who can help explain. I think Section 11 is the only section really left that I started off with, and that's ended up as kind of a study. But you'll see we have Dwayne Peoples here, and I think we have Director of Health and Social Services, and you'll have a whole range of people. And I don't know, Reneva, was that schedule put before the committee?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Reneva Moss, staff for Representative Coghill. The only sections we're going to address are sections 10 through 12. The Department of Law and Health and Social Services will address the rest of the bill. Section 10 is just an applicability clause that says that any cause of action related to subrogation, assignment, or lien that is in existence on the effective date would apply to this statute. The effective date will be July 1st, 2006, or the date of federal approval of a revised plan, which is requested in Section 12. We've directed the department to apply for a revision in their agreement with the federal government, and once that's approved, then that would serve as the effective date if it is later than July 1, 2006. Section 11 is really the meat of the original bill. In discussions with the Finance Subcommittee for Health and Social Services, there was discussion about cases where children are sent outside to residential treatment centers, and after 30 days, they become qualified for Medicaid. We couldn't get there under existing federal provisions without making some major changes to statute, so we're working on that during the interim to get to where if parents have insurance, the Denali Kid Care would look at insurance companies and how they assess treatment. What is happening is children are taken to the lower 48, placed in residential treatment centers, and it's not so much that they automatically become eligible for Medicaid. It's that the insurance company says, this child is getting level 4. We're paying for level 4 treatment, and the child is only getting level 2 treatment. So they're paying more than they feel they need to, and they cancel the coverage. So what we've asked the department to do is to look at the problems that we see, which include the authorization process compared to private insurance companies, and maximizing third-party coverage, and looking at what a parent's responsibility is for providing health care to their children, and come back to the legislature at the first of next session with recommended legislation so that we can tighten up those loopholes.
And Mr. Chairman, that's assuming that many of us will be back, of course.
So with that, Mr. Chairman, unless there's questions of the two of us, I would ask Dwayne Peoples and Stacy Crayley to come up and present the rest of the bill.
Okay. Is there any questions for the sponsor, Representative Warwick?
And Mr. Chairman, before all these kids leave, they're all from villages up north, and I think you have the list of names where they're from.
Gamble, St. Lawrence, Kotzebue, Bristol Bay, Yukon Flats, and the Lower Yukon area.
And they're from with close up to watch all the process, and I'm afraid your bill didn't keep them very long.
Nothing against your bill. And I'm sure we'll see them again.
And as we get into more detail, you'll see that it would probably chase a few more people out. But it is an important issue because people's lives and our dollars are all involved.
Sure. Okay. And if I understand her correctly, you're actually saving us some money, so we like these types of things. I don't know if that was...
That's the plan.
Okay. Okay. Very good. All right. If there's no questions for the sponsor, then thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Calgill, Ms. Renita. And for the record, we have Representative Foster and Representative Jewel Joyce. Yes, Representative Hawker is not going to make this morning, and I think Representative Kula is in flight. All right, so Dwayne, is that correct? Okay, Dwayne, we should have Dwayne Peoples and Stacy
Crayley.
Crayley, okay.
To the Chairman, for the record, my name is Dwayne Peoples, Director, Division of Healthcare Services, Department of Health and Social Services.
Stacy Crayley, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law.
Okay, go ahead.
Over the last couple of years,
the Department has been pursuing cost containment activities in the Medicaid area. One of the areas we've been looking at is a state recovery, coordinating benefits with other third-party payers, and subjugation of claims that other payers pay for medical services to Medicaid recipients. Within the last 18 months, the department has been increasing its collaboration with the Department of Law in pursuing subjugation, and Stacy Crayley is here as a partner in this activity with the Department of Law. If it's okay with the chairman and the committee, we'll just start out with Section 1 and do a quick overview and walk through them. Section 1, and I am referencing the CS of HES, on HB 426. Section 1 on page 1 is basically bringing the department in line with the recently passed Federal Budget Reduction Act, and basically it requires that the insurance companies, third-party payers in the state of Alaska, cooperate and provide information to the Department of Health and Social Services and to the Department of Law in pursuing other third-party payers for Medicaid-eligible recipients. The law enables the state to go back 3 years, 36 months on information and recovery. Any questions?
Nope.
Section 2. Basically puts the department and the state of Alaska into a more aggressive stance on subjugation in any medical claims. These claims on third parties on subjugation within the legal courts are pursued by the Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman. Go ahead, Representative Cogger.
One of the questions that I had as we went through this was on subjugation. I wonder if you could just explain the process a little bit.
For the record, again, Stacey Crayley from the Department of Law. Subrogation claims are third-party claims where the Department of Law acts as a collector of third-party claims. And so if an individual who has received Medicaid is injured in a accident, as an example, a car accident, and the department pays for Medicaid coverage for the provision of services related to that accident, and there is a third-party claim for those as related to the accident, the department has the ability to go in and recover the cost of our Medicaid expenditures. And so what will happen in those instances is an insurance company, sometimes attorneys are involved, sometimes there aren't, but generally there's insurance involved, and the department will notify the insurer, and if there's attorneys involved, the attorneys, and inform them that we have a lien for the cost of that Medicaid coverage, and we will then seek reimbursement out of the third-party recovery. So if our medical costs were $6,000 and there was a $20,000 recovery, then we assert a lien for those $6,000, and as the payment is made, there's other issues involved, but we have a right to that $6,000, and we assert that lien and request payment out of any recoveries, third-party recoveries that are made.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Kelly.
Just on that issue, does the Fed also, for their portion that they might have paid on that, do they do that at the same time, come after the insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, the state seeks recovery for both the state and federal portion.
Thank you.
During the process.
It's really elementary. You talk about the third party. Who's the first party and the second party?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, the third party references that there's an additional party to the accident who is responsible for the payment of the services. And so the third party recovery refers to the insurance company or to an individual who may be responsible for that payment. The first and the second party generally are the insurer, in this case Medicaid, and the individual who's been injured. The third party references the payor of the for with respect to the accident, generally speaking.
Okay, very good.
With the chair's permission, I will go to section 3. This section basically, again, reinforces the department's ability and information to obtain any subjugation and other third-party payments, including private insurance. Stacy mentioned some of the elements in this section in her explanation of third-party recovery under subjugation. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman. Yes, Representative Kelly has a question.
That third party is not always an insurance company, that could be someone responsible for the accident who is able to pay as well. Could that be someone other than a company?
Through the chair, that's correct.
With the chair's permission, I would go to section 4, which is on page 6.
Okay. Page 6. All right. Section 4 just
delineates the priority of recoveries and liens under this law and subjugation, putting the state only after tax and attorney's fees.
All right. Any questions on Section 4?
Thank you.
Representative Stoll.
So is this, would this fall in behind, say, if there was child support owed, would there be an avenue for or IRS or any, or is this a totally different cat we're dealing with? Usually child support and IRS liens are at the top of any list.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I don't know the exact answer to that question, but the clarification that this amendment to 4705075 does is it clarifies that we've got a lien ahead of hospital doctors and physician liens, which was we were having some difficulty with that. But I can look into where the priority would be for child support enforcement and let you know. I don't think it changes that general premise, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, if you could get back to us on that. All right, Representative Holm, question?
Yeah, I just wanted the rationale, if I could, why the state should take a first position before the providers of the services. What's the rationale of that?
Through the chair, the rationale for that is that we pay for those services, and so the idea is that if we reimburse a physician for a service that's provided or a hospital for a service that's provided, we should have priority to recover that money before the individual, because we're actually the payer of those services. And that's why we would assert a priority over those liens.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, Rex and Joel.
On that point, when that happens, are the providers of the services, can they expect that things will be taken care of in a timely manner, or are they going to be hanging out there for an extended period of time while waiting?
Through the chair, generally in the process of a Medicaid payment, the provider would have been paid. In the context of a Medicaid reimbursement issue, the provider would have been paid timely within, 90 days?
Through the chair, depending on how fast they submit their claims, we function under a 30-day payment act. So if they submit their claim in a timely, clean manner, we will pay. We run cycle once a week. We pay once a week. So if the claim is clean, it's paid. Some of these subjugation claims take years to resolve. So what we're pursuing is the money that the state has already expended in behalf of this recipient.
All right. Okay, proceed, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coghill referenced a plethora of state employees going to be testifying today. As we go into the next section, I believe somebody else will be joining us, Mr. Kevin Henderson.
I noticed there is an amendment that you want brought forward. Is that something you'll speak to at that time, or will that be
I can speak to the amendment. It relates to a different issue than what Mr. Henderson's going to speak about, so whatever's the will of the committee.
Okay. Well, if you want to stand by, then it'll be a while before we get to it.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Kevin Henderson. I'm a medical assistance administrator with the Department of Health and Social Services. Prior job, I was called the Medicaid Eligibility Program Officer. I'm actually doing something a little different right at the moment, but I'm here today, and we'll hopefully shed some light on Sections 5, 6, and 7 of this bill, which, putting the insurance companies aside and a little bit. These three sections, 5, 6, and 7, talk mostly about recipients themselves or applicants themselves. Section 5, if you were to look at Medicaid law, federal law, there's a fair amount of regulations and stuff on fraud and abuse, but it all pretty much applies to providers. There isn't much that applies to a recipient who might be lying on an application or claiming getting travel that they didn't really need or those kinds of things. And so this section here actually helps us try to enforce that kind of abuse and also addresses another thing that I'll come right back to by allowing us, the department, to actually attach or garnish the PFD of a recipient in order to recover expenditures paid on their behalf that they really didn't deserve or a result of their abuse of the program. There's another provision in current regulations that allow us to collect or get reimbursement for Medicaid expenditures on behalf of someone who has been denied, requested a fair hearing, and got continued benefits during that fair hearing time. Should they lose the fair hearing, we have the ability now to go back and seek recovery of the Medicaid expenditures for that. Those 1 or 2, 3 months, possibly at the most, of Medicaid expenditures on their behalf. The reason for that provision is to try to reduce the kind of spurious requests for fair hearings just to get a few more months of benefits that they know they don't really qualify for. Anyway, this section gives the department the same authority for Medicaid as it already has for public for food stamp program or for the temporary assistance program, basically allowing us to attach to the PFD of those recipients.
Okay. So you have a question, Representative Stoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on the garnishments, I know that just over working there's on staff and then as a legislator, when there's been garnishments by the Child Support Enforcement Division, even when there's been mistakes, it's been a bureaucratic nightmare, and there's really not a lot of due process after the money goes out. What kind of safeguards are there for the recipients when there's mistakes made, which inherently happen? Do you have any suggestions on how to provide some type of backdoor to fix problems? You get into that bureaucratic maze, and people just can't get out of it.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I'm not sure about what bureaucratic things you're talking about.
I'm sorry, I was mistaken.
Yeah, with the continued benefit recovery, there's a whole series of additional fair hearing rights. We can't actually garnish their PFD or do that without them having an additional opportunity to make their case. And so I think there's adequate safeguards and already in process there.
Okay.
Representative Jewell.
Pass.
Okay. Any other? Seeing none.
Sorry. Moving on to Section 6. Currently, federal law has a number of rules about looking at what they call transfer of assets for less than fair market value. And when somebody applies for specifically long-term care Medicaid services, we actually go back and look whether they gave money away, basically, for the purposes of qualifying for Medicaid, because they don't have that money anymore that would make them ineligible. And there are a number of ways that people can set up trusts, Medicaid trusts, that allow them to legitimately transfer resources into these trusts. And those trusts have provisions that allow the state to get that money back once they die. This particular provision in Section 6 also comes from the Deficit Reduction Act, the Federal Deficit Reduction Act, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. But It takes those same rules that apply to these special Medicaid trusts and applies them to annuities that people will purchase in order to basically take an asset, hide it in an annuity, and again, for the purposes of basically not having to pay their share and let Medicaid, you know, do it for them. So the provisions that include here is that annuities, any new annuity after the effective date of this bill would have to have a provision that Medicaid or that the department would be paid back for Medicaid services paid on their behalf, that the annuity itself had to name the state as a remainder beneficiary, and that the annuities had to be irrevocable and had to be actuarially sound. This really hasn't been a problem in this state, so this is kind of a preemptive provision, but in some states in the lower 48, it's been a huge problem with this kind of creative annuities that have allowed people to shelter assets and so that they could basically go on Medicaid. So this is kind of a preemptive thing for the state. Section 7, moving on, it's kind of a mix of things. Subsections J and K also get to a real concern of Representative Coghill, and that is that that somehow minors would be able to apply for Medicaid or someone be able to apply for Medicaid on their behalf in such a way that the authority or the responsibility that would come with the parents of that child would be circumvented somehow. And so these two subsections, J and K, basically restrict who can apply on behalf of a minor. And also says that if it doesn't preclude a minor from applying on their own, but it obligates the department to seek the parents, if it's appropriate, to seek the parents to make sure that they, if they have insurance, that insurance is paying before Medicaid. Again, to meet this idea that that those who can pay are required to pay before Medicaid. So this is a little bit of a gatekeep. It's a gatekeeping kind of provision on who can apply on behalf of a child in order to keep the parents involved as much as we can.
Okay, I think you're good.
Okay. Subsection L is a requirement that we recently have a federal approval to do, and that would require that those who are eligible for Medicare, this would be mostly the elderly and some who are disabled, that if they're eligible for Medicare, that they're required as a condition of eligibility to apply for Medicare. And I think we generally think most people sort of automatically apply for Medicare, but they may not for whatever reason. And there are some services that Medicare pays for that Medicaid doesn't, but that Medicaid is forced to pay for that Medicare could be paying for, and some of those are pretty expensive medical services. So again, this is taking advantage of that Medicare coverage of individuals, which is 100% federal funded and no state funds at all before state Medicaid funds are used. Subsection M really gets now to the heart of this new federal law that just passed in February called the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. And that federal act made a lot of changes that tend to tighten up this whole area of individuals that are seeking long-term care services in terms of, again, making sure that they're not transferring for the sake of trying to qualify for Medicaid when that money could be used to pay for their health care. And this, we're glad, the department's glad to see this provision because it really makes a nice clean tie to the Deficit Reduction Act in state law and will help us in implementing these provisions, knowing that the state's behind our efforts to do that. The provisions in the Deficit Reduction Act extend the period that we will look backwards to see if someone has transferred an asset. It extends it from 36 months of a look-back period for most people to now 60 months. And it changes when the penalty period begins for people who have been found to transfer an asset. It allows us to combine multiple smaller transfers into one. It restricts the use of life estates just a little bit to make sure that, that's a legitimate use of a life estate. And so, I mean, we can talk about those in more, those little individual things in more detail, but you're really kind of getting down to the nuts and bolts of Medicaid when we start talking at that level. But we, the department likes this provision because, again, I think the Deficit Reduction Act changes were long overdue, and generally they follow exactly the same concern that Representative Coghill has, and that the people who can pay are required to pay if they can. Subsection N, also a Deficit Reduction Act, one of the provisions in the federal law said that for long-term care recipients, that if they, normally when somebody applies for Medicaid, they have a home that they that they're living in, or that they intend to return to. That home is normally exempt, totally exempt. We don't count it. We don't make them sell it. We don't, you know, we protect the home for them. The federal law provided a requirement now that if the value, the equity value of the home exceeded $500,000, that those people basically would not be eligible for Medicaid. It would make them resource ineligible. Unless they had a unless they had a spouse still living there, or a minor child still living there, or dependent disabled child still living there. So this section of the bill addresses that provision, but it actually extends this requirement to almost all other eligibility categories, not just the long-term care recipients. So it goes a little bit beyond the Deficit Reduction Act, but basically is doing the same thing for everyone. Almost everyone. There are some categories that we can't apply this to. But. So with that, those are the sections that I know the most about, and I would certainly entertain any questions about any of those.
Any questions on Section 7? Okay. Seeing none, thank you for the explanation. Is so who's doing Section 8?
Back to Stacy.
Stacy, okay. All right. Go ahead, Ms. Crayla.
Yes. Section 8 was a proposed amendment by Representative Cisna and House Hess, which tracks language that we had been working on and also is related to the proposed amendment that you mentioned earlier, Representative Meyer.
Okay.
Basically, the genesis of this section is that the department has been sued in a couple of different cases where we have been, regarding our determination on how we terminate waiver, home and community-based waiver benefits for individuals. And the allegation raised in the litigation is that we are precluded from terminating anybody from waiver benefits who are current eligible folks unless they have been deemed to have materially improved from the previous year to the current year. And the context of the amendment is to identify how we would characterize material improvement and how we would quantify material improvement for purposes of eligibility determinations and terminating individuals from the waiver program. So Section 8 is that addresses those issues, and the proposed amendment is basically a wordsmith of that provision, which has substantively the exact same information in it. It's just written in my estimation, a little bit better, and it also clarifies some mistakes in there about we don't pay individuals for waiver benefits. We reimburse service providers for benefits, and there were a few little nuances in the original Section 8 that needed to be cleaned up. But that's Section 8 is a result of some litigation the department is currently working on or dealing with, and this would help resolve that litigation.
Okay. Any questions, Section 8? Thing up. You have Section 9 also?
Section, I think, well, I got to look at my amendment.
Section 9, wage provider.
Through the chair, my name is Dwayne Peoples. Section 9 waives a previous standing section under 4705070 that the department may waive the rights to subjugation. This section, number 9, removes that ability for the department to waive the rights. So the department would at all times be pursuing subjugation on cases against recipient claims.
This was a hardship provision?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions on that? All right. Thank you. Section, what was that, 10?
Section 10 and 11, okay. I believe the representative Coghill reviewed right. those with his staff.
Yes, yes.
If there's any further questions on 10, 11, I believe 12.
Any questions on any of these sections? We do have some additional people who testify and who are available for questions. Any questions for these folks while they're here? Okay, seeing none, Ms. Crayley, you'll stand by then for the amendment. Okay. Ms. Clark, are you going to talk about fiscal notes? There are several fiscal notes. Total of five of them?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Janet Clark, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services. Yes, Mr. Chairman, there are five fiscal notes in the bill. We prepared a spreadsheet that summarized all the fiscal notes. Does the committee have that?
Yes, we do.
I actually think this might be easier to go through because the fiscal notes are in the budget components in which the expenditures occur, and this gives an overall view of the entire fiscal impact. As you stated, Mr. Chairman, the good news on this particular bill is that it does save money. The summary we provided basically shows through fiscal year 2012 the fiscal impact of the legislation. We've also tried to show the fiscal impact by section. So if there are some changes or the legislature chooses to not include a section, then we can tell you the fiscal impact. I will tell you the first year, for fiscal year 2007, our assumption is that we will not have regulations in place until the fourth quarter. So we see savings for only 25% of a fiscal year for fiscal year 2007. Overall, in fiscal year 2007, we are calculating a savings of approximately $2.6 million between federal and state general funds, with a general fund savings of a little over $1 million, almost $1.1 million from the different provisions that have been discussed within the legislation. For fiscal year 2008, that jumps dramatically to, we project a reduction of $10.9 million overall, with a general fund savings of almost $5.1 million. So they are significant savings. The primary savings that we are calculating from this legislation is under Section 7, Subsection L. And I thought I'd spend a little bit of time on that particular item. This has to do with mandatory requirement for those individuals who are eligible for Medicare to apply for Medicare first. And thus, the federal government and that 100% federal funds would pay for those current costs that Medicaid is absorbing right now for those individuals. On the right-hand part of this spreadsheet, we do provide our assumptions. We assume there are 1,800 individuals who are in that category. We go through the calculations of how much they're costing Medicaid at the moment and then how much we're savings. But the savings is substantial from that particular item in and of itself. The other savings, there are some sections that are cost avoidance that we talk about, particularly Section 6 as well as Section 8. And then there are some smaller savings in the subrogation sections 1 through 4 and 9 through 10. Particularly, again, in FY 2008, you're going to see substantial savings. And then some smaller savings from some of the other items that we've talked about in the different sections. So that's a brief overview, Mr. Chairman, and these numbers are consistent with the fiscal notes, the five different fiscal notes that you have as you total them up.
Okay, very good. We do have some questions. First of all, let me welcome Co-Chairman Schnault. Representative Schnault, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, on your spreadsheet at the first, and you spoke to it, you'd be waiting for new regulations approved by SPA plus normal lag time. You're not figuring there'll be a savings till the fourth quarter. Is there any assurances that that's when you'll have the regulations put together? You probably know where I'm going to head next, but
through the chair, Representative Schnault, that is our best assumption. We'll have to do a state plan amendment as well with the federal government. We will make these our top priority again if the legislation is passed to get those regulations in place. I do not think that these changes are as controversial as some of our other cost containment regulations, in particular the personal care attendant regulations, where we had extensive public comment with a number of individuals, and we extended the public comment period, et cetera. So I do think that we'll be able to get these in place by that fourth quarter.
Are we, and while we're on that subject, are we close to having those regulations into place yet, or are they in effect now on the PCA?
Through the chair, Representative Schnault, they're in effect April 1st, yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Stokes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We might actually be the sponsor. Did you, and Ms. Clark probably jumped in, did you look at any on the Denali Care program and some of the looking at that program and forcing the recipients to first go to programs that pay a high percentage, whether it's ANS or Medicaid, instead of that, looking at it as the first provider as a cost containment?
That was what started, Mr. Chairman, that was what first started my discussion on this, that we had some going out for a treatment outside of Alaska that really could have been picked up by the third-party payers. I started off with a discussion of if you had household income that could be counted, say if you had people who had a child but weren't married, how do you count that household income? If you had a household income of a parent, but we just couldn't get there because of some of the federal rules, and so we ended up doing what we could. So the answer is yes, we looked. There's more to come.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. No problem.
Representative Schnault, any other questions on the fiscal notes? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Schnault.
Janet, while I'm looking at this version S spreadsheet you have, you talk about 57.58 in 07 and then down to 50% in 012. Could you explain where those numbers come from?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Schnault. The numbers come from estimates that we have already based on the national formula related to the state's federal Medicaid authorized percentage, or FMAP. As you know, the Deficit Reduction Act held the state of Alaska harmless for 2 years. Through FY 2007, our federal Medicaid percentage is 57.58%, and then we become part of the national formula. We do have estimates that in fiscal year 2008, our formula will drop our rate to 53.22% and then downward from there. We haven't seen estimates official or unofficial estimates for 2010, 11, and 12. So we've chosen the minimum at that point.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Kelp.
Bear in mind, Mr. Chairman. Okay, very good. Any other questions for Ms. Clark? Thank you. Okay, let's see, who else do we have to testify? I think, is it Ms. Fitzgerald? Are you on for questions or? Oh, you're here. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I was here to, with the department to be able to answer questions if you're ready.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And then on teleconference, Jim Davis with the Northern Justice Project.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me? I'm calling in from Anchorage.
I can, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am, my name is Jim Davis. I'm an attorney with the Northern Justice Project. I'm actually the attorney for the cases that Stacey Crailey discussed that have to do with Section 8 of this bill. I attempted to testify before the House test last week, but somehow the call wasn't patched through. But I would just like to take, if I could, a couple minutes in front of a committee and explain why I think Section 8 is bad policy for the state, if I may.
Okay, go ahead.
The choice waiver program for older Alaskans, as you may all know, is a program where older Alaskans with serious disabilities are provided with choice waiver benefits in lieu of these Alaskans being institutionalized in nursing homes. Financially speaking, it saves the state more money on the choice waiver program for a disabled Alaskan than if the Alaskan were institutionalized. What's happened is that a lot of older Alaskans who have been on the choice waiver program for years because the state itself found these older Alaskans to be severely disabled were, in the last couple years, reassessed and found that they had improved. One case in particular, I'm not going to mention the name of the individual, but is a 92-year-old lady who's suffering from Alzheimer's disease who has been suffering from that disease for years and has been on this program for the last 5 or 6 years. She certainly hasn't improved, and none of her doctors would say that she has improved, but when the state assessed her this past year or so, the state said, you have improved, and attempted to terminate her benefits. The assessment that Section 8 addresses is a 45-minute or so question set that's done by a for-profit Wyoming company that's been hired by the state a couple years ago. When the assessments are done, in this particular case of a 92-year-old Alaskan, the assessment in 1 year will say she's no longer disabled, whereas the assessment in a prior year says she was disabled. What occurs is that there are different assessors doing the assessment, and they come to subjectively different opinions. What it leads to is an unfair situation where folks that if you ask their doctors, they haven't medically improved, and just from common knowledge, people with Alzheimer's don't improve, especially if they're 92 years old. But because of the 45-minute assessment and the subjective nature of such tests, that the department will say to this person, you've improved, we're going to terminate your benefits, and lead that person to a life or death situation. Now, a couple lawsuits were filed, and I have nothing but the highest respect for Stacey Crailey, and I don't want to have this come across as anything but the highest respect, but two courts found, these are not allegations, two superior courts in Alaska found that if the state finds somebody's disabled, the state can't simply take away those benefits unless the state can show that there's been some material improvement. These aren't allegations. These are findings by judges. One long-term judge, Judge Hopwood, who's known to not be a liberal but to be fiscally conservative and legally conservative, and Judge Hopwood said it is so unfair to take away somebody's benefit when the state in the previous years has continually found them disabled that it's unconstitutional. As you all probably know, the state has to act as a fair player in context, and if it acts arbitrarily or unfairly, it's sometimes unconstitutional. That's what Judge Hopwood found, and Judge Hopwood ordered the state to stop taking away these benefits until and unless the state showed that these folks had materially improved. What this amendment, what Section 8 intends to do, is to legalize what, in fact, two courts have already said is illegal. What Section 8 proposes to do is to say, if there's an assessment, which there is, and if the assessment shows the person has improved, which it does oftentimes, and if that assessment is ratified by a nurse, and they're always ratified by the nurses that are working for the DSDS, the person's benefits shall be taken away. That's the precise process that two courts have said is so unfair to be unconstitutional. It's going to lead to more litigation, which is a minor concern. The major concern is going to lead to a lot of disabled older Alaskans who, if anybody asks their doctors, the folks who know best what their medical conditions are, the doctors would say, Ms. Jones hasn't improved. She's not going to improve. She only has a few years left in her life, and these diseases are the kind that worsen over time. You're going to have a lot of people, pioneers of our state, rendered in a life or death situation. If you take these essential services away, they will either die or they will be institutionalized in a nursing home, and the ultimate cost of the state if an elder is institutionalized is dramatically higher than if the elder is receiving choice waiver benefits, as well as the quality of life for the elder in a nursing home versus being allowed to live her last years in her own home with some services provided to her. So I think it's bad policy for the state. I think it's going to lead to a proposed ratification of what two courts have already found to be unconstitutional. And I would ask this committee to think long and hard if it really wants to allow a 45-minute assessment that's subsequently ratified by a nurse who's usually never met the Alaskan to have that elder left in a situation where if anybody talked to their doctors say this individual, this woman has not improved. And I think a simple proposal would be the state could simply get a certification from the doctor, has this patient improved or not, and go with that. Allowing an assessment which two courts have already found to be arbitrary to be the determinative factor, I would submit is not how we Alaskans want to treat the folks who helped build this state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Davis. Any questions for Mr. Davis? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Okay, was there anyone else who wanted to testify online or here in Juneau? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the public testimony. Let's go ahead and take amendments. We do have Amendment 1, which actually is going to, looks like it deals with the section that the Mr. Davis was talking about. So, Ms. Crayley, were you going to come back up for this? I will go ahead and move Amendment 1.
Object.
It's been moved and objected to. Ms. Crayley, do you want to describe what this amendment does, please?
Yes, again, for the record, my name is Stacey Crayley with the Department of Law, and the amendment, as I mentioned earlier, is a is a wordsmith of the existing Section 8 in the version we were talking about earlier that had been drafted and we reviewed, and there were a number of nuances in that original Section 8 that needed to be clarified, specifically the reference that home and community-based services would be paid to an individual. We don't pay for services to the individual, we pay service providers, similar nuances such as that. And as you look at the back part of the amendment, let me find it here, the lead-in language was complicated and not well written, and so we suggested changes to that to clarify. Now, with respect to the substance of the amendment, and and somewhat to respond to what Mr. Davis has talked about, the lawsuits that were filed allege that we could not terminate anybody from a home and community-based waiver program without showing material improvement. And material improvement is an undefined concept at this point in the state of Alaska, and frankly, it's undefined anywhere in the nation from what I can tell. And so what we have tried to do is we've tried to fashion a remedy to this allegation through this amendment so that we would have a standard upon which we would assess and reassess every individual who was put on a waiver program before we terminated their eligibility. notwithstanding Mr. Davis's comments, I think it's important to realize that a waiver is a benefit that's provided upon a determination of eligibility. And the assessment tool that he mentions is a new assessment tool that was identified and adopted as a result of past litigation in 2003, where we had been sued because our assessment tool was not medically based and was inappropriate and had not been properly adopted through the Administrative Procedures Act. We developed this consumer assessment tool that he references. We had properly adopted it through regulation, and a court signed off on that assessment as being appropriate. The litigation at hand, there are two preliminary injunctions that have been issued. The preliminary injunctions say that there's a reasonable likelihood that they may prevail on the merits, that is, that we will have to show material improvement. There has not been a final determination on the merits of their allegations, nor has there been a final determination on the merits of what material improvement means. And so what this amendment attempts to do is to qualify and define what material improvement is and how we will assess material improvement so that individuals who are not appropriate to be on a waiver are no longer on a waiver. A waiver is a yearly benefit. You're assessed and you have to be reassessed every year by state and federal law. And so there is no presumption that once you're on a waiver that you get a waiver for the rest of your life. Now, many individuals do receive waiver benefits for their entire lives or for many, many years, or elderly Alaskans may qualify and be on a waiver until they pass away. But there's no guarantee that you get a waiver 1 year, you get it for the rest of your life. We have to reassess and establish eligibility, and this is what this amendment does. The idea also is that the review is not I think the inference was that it's a rubber stamp, that the assessment comes in and the next year the assessment comes in and then there's a review of it and it would just be a rubber stamp. What we're trying to do is establish a premise where we would look at this year's assessment, last year's assessment, and make sure that there had been material improvements so that the termination of the benefits could take place. At this point, there is no review of prior year assessments when we determine. If you score a 5 or above on a consumer assessment tool, you're eligible. If you score 5 or below, you're not eligible, but we don't look at prior years. And under this premise, we would look at prior years and we would have to explain, well, if you scored a 7 last year and you got a 3 this year, what changed? And that's the concept that is being identified here. So I respectfully disagree with Mr. Davis's characterization that it would be a rubber stamp type process. We're trying to meet his allegations and his complaint. The inference that the judge has given us that we have a pretty high burden to show, to terminate waiver benefits. And in doing so, we've established a program or a process that we think would meet everybody's needs and, again, establish only those individuals who are eligible for waivered services would continue to receive waivered services.
Okay. Very good. Any questions on Amendment 1? Ms. Crayley.
Yeah.
Rips and Jewel.
Can you make that assessment without ever having observed the person in question?
Through the chair, Representative Jewel, I'm glad you asked that question. The assessments are done in person. They are not done without a face-to-face interview. And as they are currently done, the assessments are conducted by a contractor, as Mr. Davis mentioned, and that individual receives information from the individual and from the family and from the care coordinator, family being sons, daughters, you know, friends, anybody that has access to that individual for an elderly person. And that assessment is then conducted. It's a 45-minute in-person kind of interview. You review medical records. You talk to providers. You get as much information as you can. And you observe the individual in their home setting to determine what their score is. And then what will happen is that score will come out. And if there is a conflict, pursuant to the previous lawsuit I mentioned, if there is a conflict where the assessment the numbers just don't jive. The department has nurses who work in the long-term care unit for the OA, Older Alaskans waiver, and they then paper review that, and they will go out and conduct their own assessment. So we don't assess folks based upon like a desk audit, I guess, would be an analogous comment. We go out and we observe the individuals in their homes and in their community settings, whether that be assisted living home or where have you. But it is an in-person interview.
Hello? And it says here that it has to be reviewed by an independent qualified healthcare professional. Who gets to define or determine who's qualified?
The amendment qualifies who identifies who that would be. There are four different waivers in the state of Alaska, and in order to qualify for the mental retardation developmental disability waiver, a qualified healthcare professional would be what's called a QMRP. They're specialized individuals who deal with mental health and developmental disabilities as defined by statute. The remainder under the amendment, individuals to assess the other three waivers would be the healthcare professionals as defined in the amendment, which include nurses, advanced nurse practitioners, and those sorts of individuals. I think it's important to also realize that what we deal with in these waivers is nursing level of care. It's, as Mr. Davis mentioned, the idea is that but for the provisions of these services, these individuals would be institutionalized in nursing homes. So the nursing facility level of care is not necessarily a medically based decision. It's more of a nursing facility. So that's why we are looking at nurses and folks who deal with long-term care issues to make these decisions as opposed to a general practitioner.
Thank you.
Representative Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The gentleman who testified, is he in litigation now with the state?
Yes, through the chair, yes, he is.
And represented by attorney?
Through the chair, Mr. Rarick, Jim Davis is an attorney with the Northern Justice Project. He's one of the lead attorneys in the number of suits we have with his office right now.
I just know that individuals who have problems with the state sometimes end up in court, and the state has such power they can come to administrative agency or the legislature and get a fix, and that leaves a litigant out in the cold holding the bag. Are they, will this remedy the legal issue, and what about any costs incurred by the individual? How would that be handled if the bill passes?
Through the chair, I'm not really sure what your question is.
In other words, does this moot the legal challenge, legal issue that's brought to court?
Through the chair, that Representative Wyrock, that is the hope that it would resolve the litigation. And the premise for putting this forward in a legislative framework, one is to clearly identify what the rules are so everybody knows how we are administering the program. And the second part of it is that as a result of the restraining or the injunctive orders that have been issued, the department has been completely foreclosed from making any sort of administrative or management decisions with respect to those waivers at this point. So we are not terminating anybody who applies or is reassessed for a waiver. And that creates administrative burdens and backlogs that are a bit overwhelming. And waiting for this to resolve itself through litigation, whether that be through the Superior Court or the Supreme Court, is a very lengthy process, as you know. And so we were hoping to solve the question, address their issue of material improvement through litigation, or through legislation, rather, through litigation, so that we can get this program back up and running.
Yeah, my concern, though, is they've had to go to a lot of time, money, and effort to get this far. If this solves the problem, then are they just out whatever resources they've already expended? Is there some remedy that the state still can give these private individuals that have to take on the power of the government in order to redress the grievance?
Through the chair, Representative Barrywalk, I mean, litigation is ongoing, and so if the legislation passes and the issue is mooted and the court agrees with our premise that the legislation would moot the litigation, they would still have the ability to seek attorney's fees and recoveries in that sense.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions on Amendment 1? Is there any objections to adopting Amendment 1? Okay. Seeing none, then Amendment 1 will be accepted. Okay, so we have the bill back before us as amended. We discussed the fiscal notes. Is there any other additional questions for the sponsor or for administration? Representative Kelly.
Just while Representative Coghill's here, I wanted to thank him for this as we all know, making cost savings and improvements in the test system is just hard work on the ground, and Representative Coghill and the people who have been helping him, I want to commend all of them for that. The second thing is just to take it to the level, is there a communication with our Washington delegation in areas where you feel it would be appropriate to try to get some assistance from them? For example, you mentioned one area that you couldn't do it, you had to kind of give up because of the Fed system, and sometimes based on your judgment, you probably couldn't make headway there. But where you can, are you making that connection?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes. Part of it is how we revise our plan. Some of it is how we interface with the new law changes under their Budget Deficit Reduction Act. Some of it is fighting like crazy to try to keep our FMAP at the right level. So I'm going to give kudos to the department. I think they've been very good there. But I will continue the discussion as long as the public sends me back here.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, a great number of folks are having trouble getting waivers, at least in our area. There's been a backlog for a great number of period of time, and I was just wondering if this would transfer some of the assets so that they would be appropriately dispersed to those that really are in need. Do you envision that is going to be the end result or one of the end results of this?
Mr. Chairman, that's the reason I'm doing this, is to make sure that the assets do get to the needy. The waiver issue is going to be an ongoing discussion, there's no doubt about it. But we want to make sure that those that can take care of themselves have the assets to do it, aren't taking them away from somebody else. So that's the focus, and hopefully it doesn't land unfairly. I will watch it as close as I can, but I'm confident that with what we put in here, it's a very fair process.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up. I really appreciate that, because I think of one of the things that what we do is we always watch our nickels, but we have an obligation as a society to take care of those who cannot take care of themselves, and those that really need to rent and have that assistance rendered. I'm in full agreement that those waiver processes should be handled as rapidly and as carefully as possible. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. I would agree to Representative Coghill. You've taken on a big task here, and you've done a good job with it. And I know our HESS subcommittee expert, Representative Hocker, also supports this bill. So with that, Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move HB 426 out of committee with individual recommendations as amended with the attached fiscal notice.
Any objection? Seeing none, go past the committee. Thank you, Representative.
Chairman, thank you.
Okay, let's go on now to House Bill 500. Representative Stoltz is going to tell us what this is all about. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Others besides me are going to do most of the talking.
Okay, we do have
on this. Yeah. But it's a fairly simple bill. It makes a minor change in the language on the scope of the project, and it increases the ADA eligibility for that. That the borough and this developer can seek from ADA. It's not a guarantee. It sets the limit. Certainly, a lot more process and due diligence by ADA and probably half of the borough talking to their voters and their constituency to convince them this is a good project as well. So a lot of process ahead of us. This is putting one of the pieces in so that if the case can be made for this, it's that much further ahead. So it's in a nutshell. And okay. There's some.
Very good. Yes, I do have. I'll let you introduce yourself. I've got your name, sir. But
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is David Germer, and I work for JL Properties, and I'm the project manager of the Hatcher Pass project. As Representative Stoltz stated, HB 500 increases AIDA's existing authorization to finance the Hatcher Pass project from $15 million to $25 million. Now, AIDA's financing can only be made available after AIDA finishes its due diligence analysis and the project is determined to be able to pay back AIDA's investment. Second, all regulatory and statutory requirements have to be met. And lastly, AIDA's board obviously has to approve the financing. To give you a little background of the project, in October of 2003, JL Properties responded to a public solicitation by the Matsu Borough. That solicitation was to develop an alpine as well as a Nordic ski area at the Hatcher Pass project. JL was selected by the borough a couple of months later to work on the Hatcher Pass project to develop both the alpine as well as the Nordic ski venues for the project. Over a two-year period, JL and its team of consultants have worked with the borough and AIDA to develop a very preliminary conceptual plan as well as some conceptual financial plans to develop both the alpine and the Nordic ski areas. These plans have met the borough's goals. Now, the development plan consists of three integrated pieces. And if you look at the handout that I handed you, you'll see a slide, the second slide, that is project scope. Those three pieces consist of an alpine area and a lodge slash visitor center, Southside residential area, and lastly, a Nordic ski trail system that includes both a stadium and a chalet. There was at one point in time a commercial village component, and that has subsequently been deleted. Now, as far as the alpine area is concerned, the next slide shows the location of these three components relative to one another. I think that's important to see that the alpine area lies approximately 2 miles north of the Southside residential community area, which is shown with the dotted blue line, and the Nordic ski trail system area is shown in yellow. Now, in regards to the alpine ski area, the next slide in your package, this is a regional ski resort. It will have a capacity of roughly 2,300 skier day capacity. Its primary lift will be a high-speed detachable quad. It would be an upper mountain T-bar, be a lower mountain platter lift, and at the base there will be a day lodge slash visitor center. There will also be snowmaking and trail riding there. Next slide shows the location on the mountain face of the lifts as well as the various ski runs. Now, the second component I said was the Southside residential area. We have defined 26 development pods. If you look at the next slide, you can see how these development pods might lie within the Southside area. And within these development pods, there's up to 450 residential lots. These lots range in size from maybe 1 to 5 acres, and they'd be developed over roughly a 20 to 25 year period. We've allowed for large open space provisions. Matter of fact, 68% has been set aside for open space. Any development in this area would have strict development guidelines in terms of both landscaping as well as architecture. We would view possibly having a sledding hill in this area as well as a equestrian center. Now, the next slide talks about the Nordic ski trail system, the stadium, and the chalet. We're going to develop a variety of trail systems. Those are shown on the right-hand side of this slide. Predominantly the Nordic trails, but there will also be recreational trails, hiking trails, equestrian trails. Our Nordic ski trail system was designed by Alaskan Olympian Bill Spencer, and it would consist of both beginner, intermediate, and competition.
trails. We have had an extreme amount of interest associated with the
Nordic ski trail system
in terms of holding competitive events here. We could hold high school, collegiate, as well as even national events within the ski trail system. If you look at the last page of the slideshow, this shows the various different types of trails. The trail system, if you overlay this slide with the residential lots, you'll see that this trail system runs between the various development areas, and just about every potential lot has access to one of these trail systems. Now, it's important to recognize that that each of these three project components need to be integrated for this project to be a success and to succeed. We've been developing a finance plan that has been a challenge. This plan provides a rather unique blend of both public and private sector financing. And ADA's participation in this financing plan, we believe, is an integral part of the success of this project. As such, we are requesting today that ADA's authorization to assist in this financing be increased from the $15 million to $25 million. Now, the next step for both ADA, the borough, as well as JL Properties, is to conduct detailed due diligence and analysis. Up to this point in time, our work has been based predominantly upon existing published information and limited amount of field work. So each entity would do their due diligence analysis. This could begin this summer. And after the due diligence work is completed and financial feasibility of the project has indeed been determined, ADA's board would need to approve the financing before the project could proceed. And we're hopeful that construction could indeed begin by the spring of 2008. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none.
Real quick.
Representative Schultz.
Just a general question on compatibility with the proposed mining development nearby.
Through the chair to Representative Schultz. The area of the Alpine area as well as the south side area is 3 to 4 miles from the proposed mining area and the Hatcher Pass, the old Hatcher Pass mining area.
Thank you.
Representative Kelly?
Just not familiar with the project. Who are the principals on the with the JL?
The two principals owners of JL Properties are Jonathan Rubini and Leonard Hyde.
On the risk assessment, about the second question, on the land, they own the land, what's the situation with
the land? The land today is owned by the Mat-Su Borough, and this would be a public-private partnership with the Mat-Su Borough.
And the risk assessment is something that the ADA board will judge the risk. That won't come, we won't see that again.
Yes, my understanding is ADA would complete a due diligence analysis of the project along with JL Properties and Matsubaro to some extent. And financial feasibility would be determined by ADA.
Thank you.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Chairman. On your map that shows the mountain development concept, is that the old road that goes through Hatcher Pass?
Through the chair, the approximately where that
two lifts.
The line that goes up through here is the road that goes up to Hatcher Pass.
I was looking at this one.
Oh, at the very base of that is where the road is.
I've only driven there one time, but there was a lodge up there. Isn't there a lodge up on top of the hills?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That from this picture, that would be up about
okay,
here.
That's further on up. Okay. Yeah. I'm just trying to get a concept of where you were.
It's lower down from where the... lower down the hillside from where the existing lodge is.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Mr. Duffy, did you have
Mr. Chairman,
comments? You bet.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Duffy. I'm the borough manager for the Mississippi Borough. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and thank you for considering House Bill 500. The Mat-Su Borough is fully supportive of your consideration and adoption of House Bill 500. It provides for ADA's participation in the project, which we believe is critical to the ultimate success of the effort. This project has been a long-standing borough economic development effort. We've been working on it well over 20 years, and we believe we are the closest we've ever been to making it a reality. As Mr. Gurman has mentioned, it is a public-private partnership. The borough is in control of the land. We have title to 3,000 acres where development will occur. We obtained the property through the Municipal Entitlement Program, and as you're aware, that program provided land to the municipalities for economic development, tax-based diversification, and recreational opportunities, and this project fulfills all of those goals. We have utilized borough and state funds in the past to move this project along. We have brought electrical power in that was provided through a grant. Senator Green was instrumental in obtaining for us. We provided local funds for geotechnical and hydrological work. We have completed the economic feasibility of the project. This was funded by the borough. We've provided the funds to ADA so that we had independent third party look at it. That was conducted by Economic Research Associates out of San Francisco. And that analysis came back saying that this project does make economic sense. We have strong cooperation with the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Lands, as well as State Parks, and we've been working very closely with them. We have completed a economic impact assessment of the effort. This was completed by Northern Economics out of Anchorage, and the structure cost assessments of the effort of approximately $42 million. The Alpine Nordic ski area would create approximately 360 jobs, and a Southside development approximately 1,350 jobs. To sum up, we support ADA's ability to participate in the project and support House Bill 500. It will fulfill the long-term economic development and recreational goal of the borough, creates numerous long-term jobs, fulfills the goals of the Municipal Entitlement Program, and built upon previous state and borough investments. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Any questions? Representative Kelly.
Looks like an exciting project. How much skin in the game will JL be just managers, builders and managers of it, or are they owners, partial owners? What's the structure that we look at? How does that work?
But at this point in time, we're looking at it as a joint project where initially all proceeds from the development of the project would go into a general fund and used entirely to pay off all project debt and all project equity. At that point in time, profits would be distributed approximately 33% between the Mat-Su Borough, JL, and ADA. That's the preliminary financial plan as it exists today, but again, we're in the process of just kicking off our due diligence efforts.
And then, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelly.
What's the debt equity load?
I can't recall it this time. Do you recall, Jim?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jim McMillan. I'm Deputy Director of Credit and Business Development for ADA. The preliminary, and I emphasize preliminary, financial plan or concept that was presented is, first of all, this is about a $42 million project. JL will have a minimum of $5 million into the project. The Mat-Su Borough will have approximately $10 million. And then if ADA proceeds with the financing, it will have up to $25 million in the project. In terms of the structure of the financing, the initial concept was an equity role for ADA in the project, along with JL Properties and along with the Matsu Borough. The final structure, of course, will be dependent on the due diligence and the feasibility of this, but initially and conceptually, that was the structure, Representative Kelly.
Okay, so will ADA have essentially a mortgage on the whole shooting match?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, what's probably more important to us, and I think of what is of great value in this project, are the development rights. And that's what we're initially looking at. That does not mean that we will not have some type of security above and beyond an assignment of those development rights that may run to the property itself. But initially, we're focusing in on what brings the most value to this project. And the land by itself, of course, does have intrinsic value. But the real value of this project is the development rights.
Just a concern, I mean, Chena Hot Springs is within your memory and mine.
Yes.
Didn't work very well. Nobody came. Flopped. And I'm just curious. Sometimes ADA gets delivered something to do that they really didn't want. They get it delivered by us, and we say, go do it. And I just wonder if the if we've got those sorts of conventional protection here that won't make this something we have to ever see again, except to go ski there.
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, I would like to make the comment that I hope that ADA learns from its past projects, and I think we've become wiser each time. We, as you know, the original legislation in 1998, we looked at financing this project. It didn't go anywhere for a number of reasons. The developer backed away. Developer felt that they couldn't get the return on their investment. As we started to go through the due diligence process with the previous developer, because the risk profile was higher than we wanted to take on, we were requiring more money from the developer. So I guess the way I like to look at it is that ADA is not a risk-averse business. Whenever you're providing funding or money, you can't be risk-averse, otherwise you would probably have no money that would ever go out the door. Our job is to identify what the risks are in any project that ADA gets involved in, and then do its utmost to find ways to mitigate those risks. And that's what we will do through the due diligence process. You know, as was indicated earlier, and ADA does support the passage of House Bill 500, this is just an initial process, and passage of this bill, as it did back in 1998, doesn't guarantee that this project is going to get financed. Only after we go through and look at the technical, the operational, and all the financial issues, and then put together a finance plan that shows that this project can pay back the investment that ADA puts into it, will it then even go to the Board of Directors for their consideration?
Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Chairman Chenault. And I had some of the same concerns as Representative Kelly. That's why I feel my role was to facilitate this opportunity, and the borough puts it on the table, and I had conversations. I wanted to make sure that ADA actually was comfortable with the legislation and that they thought it was a good idea. It's on the starting point. And I agree, if you look at the history of the ADA failures, there's a big tail of legislative involvement forcing ADA into the majority of those. So I wanted to make sure that there was that ADA thought that it made economic sense to start this process. And I had to get over that same comfort level. And knowing the same history that you alluded to, and I was certainly more comfortable knowing that this was the beginning of a long process. So.
I guess.
Representative Kelly.
Just since we're on the record, we probably won't have another cut at this, and that's probably appropriate given the size of it. The it just seems to me that that, and JNL has a good success record. They come to us with some experience in the state and long residency of the principals, et cetera. And so it's not a negative at all, but the amount of the equity in there is a concern, and I'm sure it is as you guys thrash this out to see whether $5 million coming to the table is enough. Just a question that I have. And the second thing is, I guess, after listening to the story, and forgive me for being brand new, because except for knowing, flown over it lots of times, I'm not real familiar with the area up there. But the other thing is a mortgage that just reached out and took the whole thing, because when trouble comes, everybody leaves Ada's boat and they're standing there. And so two points to make, just to demonstrate a concern about the level of equity. And then the other is the ability of Ada to be able to reach in and try to turn it around with the kind of control that would be appropriate given the level that they're putting in. Just a comment, it's nothing negative. Looks like a very exciting project. I mean, I can see where that thing might really take off. Thank you, Mr.
Jim, did you have any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, just one final comment. Ada has a long history with this project. I think any of us that have been around for a while knows the history of this project, its failures, and you can't help but be skeptical, and I'm speaking of Ada, because nobody has been able to make a go of it. And we have been involved in, as John Duffy indicated, some feasibility studies to look at and answer the question, really, what is it going to take to make this a viable project? There's got to be some way to put this together and make it viable. And we were doubting Thomas's, to be quite honest with you. But we looked long and hard at the concept that was presented to us by JL. There were a number of reasons that we felt it was worthwhile moving forward. We thought the history of the developer was a very positive one. A developer who normally doesn't get into projects unless he's going to succeed. The timing, the growth in the valley, and most important, this is an integrated project. Previous projects, and one of the reasons I think for the previous developer not moving forward, is everything that we've been told is it's not profitable just to have an alpine ski area. Here we have an integrated project, as David Germer talked about, with different pods of development. And it's only with that we think it makes sense. We think it's worthwhile at least taking the next step to move forward on this.
Any other questions? Representative Wyrock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that there's still going to be a significant public process on all of this. Is that right?
Chairman, that's correct.
Because part of the reason I ask is because I don't know anything about this project. I have a lot of respect for the sponsor of the bringing the issue forward, but there's been a lot of concerns raised about public funding for private, commercial, and housing subdivision development, increasing public exposure, opening up areas to housing developments, degradation of habitat and stuff. So I assume that this is all going to have to come out in the public process. The Mat-Su Borough and others have a hand in this. We're just giving the authority to allow Ada to float some bonds after it receives a lot more process, both on its own board and through a public process. Is that correct? Is my understanding correct?
Yeah, there's plenty of there's going to be plenty of opportunities for public comment. We have the development agreement, which will have to be reviewed by our Parks and Rec Board, or Real Estate Asset Management Board, and then ultimately the plant rural assembly. We have a special use district to address a number of the concerns that you raised. That will also have to go through a number of public hearings. There's going to be quite a bit of public participation in this to come.
Representative Jewell.
When do you project the end of this process where you actually will, once you make your determination, whether this is a go or no go? I guess where I'm headed with that question is, why are we seeing this bill now and not along with it, the public process, the business plan as opposed to the development plan?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Jewell, under our statutes for development finance projects, any project that we fund in excess of $10 million requires very early on legislative authorization to move forward. That is normally the beginning of whether you want to call it the business plan or the due diligence process.
So that takes it off.
Right. It takes place after the authorization. I might also additionally address Representative Wyrock's comment. In addition to Matsu Burrell's public process that they will go through, ADA has another public process beyond this. We do not go into anybody's backyard and participate in a development finance project unless the local governing body passes a resolution consenting to the location. That is in addition to and on top of anything the Matsu Borough may have to go through.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Next, we will go to public testimony. Is there anyone here in the room that would like to speak to HB 500? Seeing none, I don't believe we have anyone online. So with that, I will close public testimony, and we'll look at amendments at this time. I don't see any unless there's somebody that has a amendment. If not, we will move to the fiscal note. Department of Commerce has a zero fiscal note. And with that, if there's no other comments, Representative Foster.
Yeah, I did want to say, Mr. McMillan, I don't think I've seen him for 30 years, huh? He used to be the banker in Nome. And I know there are some questions here as to how prudent his fiscal management is, but I did want to say that I remember in 1974, he offered me a toaster if I had to close my account, so he is. But I got the pen. I stole a pen there for him. And I wanted to welcome you here to the committee, Jim, and also the professional testimony of the two people that you've got with you. I'll go ahead and move HB 500 out of committee with the attached zero fiscal note with individual recommendations.
Objections. Seeing none, HB 500 moves out of committee.
Yeah, I got a toaster.
Next, we will move on to House Bill 496, Representative Seaton and Louis Flora.
I tell Jim he's lucky he didn't have his birthday.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you again.
Hold on a second. Let's let some people get out of the room. All right, Mr. Fuller, if you want to go ahead and present House Bill 496.
For the record, my name is Louis Flora. I'm staff to Representative Seaton and Committee 8 for the House State Affairs Committee. House Bill 496 is sponsored by the House State Affairs Committee. It's the companion piece to the bill in the Senate State Affairs with some modifications to it. I want to first apologize. Representative Seaton can't be here. He's about 5,000 feet above Prince William Sound right now. So, and then just preemptively for the fiscal note, that was kind of an administrative bungle on my part as the committee aide, in that we sent it out with a zero from the House State Affairs Committee. But the correct fiscal note is from the PFD division. I believe you have that in your packets.
Department of Revenue.
Yeah,
393,000.
393. House Bill 496 establishes an electronic checkoff system for the permanent fund dividend applicants to select a eligible charitable organization of their choice to donate a portion of their permanent fund dividend to. It also allows for community foundations to be part of the system, and also campuses of the University of Alaska, vocational education organizations, and post-secondary education organizations. And so that's just on the electronic application. As far as the charitable organizations, there's a number of criteria that begin on page 2, line 24 of the bill, and runs through page 3, line 21. And that's standard criteria to determine the eligibility of the charitable organization. So they're not a fly-by-night organization just getting in on the program. It establishes that they've been around a while. The House State Affairs Committee put in an allowance for community foundations. That's on page 3, starting on line 18, and it creates an exemption. There's a requirement for the charitable organizations that they must not make grants or contributions to organizations that are exempt under USC 501c4 or C6, but because some community foundations make grants to chambers of commerce and rotary organizations, which are C4 and 6, the House State Affairs Committee put in a exemption for up to 10% of the community foundation funding can go to those organizations and still be eligible. And it looks back retroactively, so in the past 2 years to the time that they apply for being put on the list, they can have made up to 10% of their grants eligible to 501c4 and C6. In the fiscal note that you have before you from the Permanent Fund Division, it estimates that 600 or more organizations may be eligible. This program is presented in the bill is with an understanding from the Rasmussen Foundation that they will underwrite the cost of the program for the first 3 years, and there is a 2009 sunset date on it. Another change, aside from the community foundation eligibility that the House State Affairs Committee put in, was the requirement that the organizations be put in on the electronic application in alphabetical order. It was in random order at first. That was thought to be a little too cumbersome. And with that, I'll be here to answer questions, and there is representatives from the Rasmussen Foundation and the Permanent Fund Division here as well.
Any questions? Representative Weirock.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. On page 1 of the bill, line 11, this is limited to those who file applications electronically. Why just electronically? Why not paper applications?
Through the chair, Representative Weirock, it's my understanding that this would be less cost prohibitive, but I believe the Permanent Fund Division could speak to that. The cost of putting that on the paper application as well.
Okay.
Sharon, would you like to come forward? This is Sharon Barton, Director of Permanent Fund Division.
Mr. Chairman, Sharon Barton, Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, Representative Weirock. That actually was not a request by the department, but the Senate sponsor preferred to limit it to electronic filers. I believe he was hoping to simplify it on our behalf, but it was not our request.
Two questions, and one is what percent file electronically? I assume it has been growing over time. And number two, is it better administratively to limit to this provision to those who file electronically as opposed to paper?
Representative Wyrock, this year, I'm happy to tell you approximately 55% will have filed electronically for the 2006 dividend. The fiscal note would, in fact, increase a fair amount if paper applications were included. All of the, as you see, a participant can designate as many different organizations and in as many different amounts as they desire. So each of those would have to be keyed in off the application and would be fairly labor intensive. I haven't calculated that cost, but would be happy to do it.
Okay.
Representative,
I have about seven questions. Can I just go through these?
Sure.
Okay. On page two, the line two, the words contribution list, roughly how many pages do you anticipate that's going to be, or how many, what kind of a list is that? It's contained in the electronic application, so you're just going to go, it's going to click on something like you do when you make a reservation. It's going to bring up like this list of cities when you're flying somewhere. That's what you envision happening?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wyrock, we don't have that scoped out in detail. The sponsor has, again, the Senate sponsor has asked if we would provide a sort function electronically. So the list would reside in the database, could come up alphabetically if a person wanted to see the whole list, or as I envision it, they might want to sort it by geographic location or by kind of organization.
Okay. Then on the same line, you've got these weird figures, 25, 50, 75, 100, then 10, 25, 50%, 100%. Why those numbers specifically?
Representative Wyrock, those are proposals by the sponsor. Those were not, we were not consulted on those,
okay,
that part of the proposal.
Then moving down, it seems like there's this provision that deals with the problem that the general public's going to have dealing with doing this, and that is if there's more, or, you know, it's going to default to the division to determine the elections. Wouldn't it be easier, rather than putting dollar amounts, just to put percent amounts? Then it doesn't matter what the amount of the dividend is. You're just simply dealing with percentages.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wyrock, because it will be computerized, it will take more. It will take more programming to set up both schemes, and it will be more complicated on the administrative side, working with contributors after the fact. We envision that many of them will come back in and want to change these contributions. So, in the course of the time between March 31st and payment season. So to that extent, it would be simpler if it were one or the other. My understanding was the sponsor was trying to cover all possibilities with all participants, but it does make it more complicated.
Representative Lyra.
And then further on line 12, the department shall provide statement of contributions. We're just talking like putting on the stub of a check to permit for nothing inordinately in terms of exotic, in terms of record keeping. This can be simple on the check stub. Yes.
Chairman, Representative Wyrock, that's true. We currently issued the check stub is the 1099. In addition, for anyone who makes an assignment or has a garnishment, they also receive a letter of advice on that front. So there would be additional letters sent out, but the advice would serve as the 1099.
Okay. Then on page 3, line 14, has to be a CPA involved here. And it's only if the assets exceed $250,000. I was curious, is it the intent of the sponsor that be the case? Because if you change the word on line 14, the last word, to whether instead of if, then everyone would have to justify that.
So I just wonder what the sponsor's intent is. Is it to only if the dollar amounts exceed $250, or even in any event, that there has to be some certification by some qualified accountant to provide some information to the dividend division that's a qualifying organization?
Through the chair, Representative Weirach, we were working off the Senate State Affairs version with this criteria. I would have to go back and do some more research on that and get back to you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Weirach.
It seems like that Section D on that page, page 3, department to use equal percentage of the total amount contributed under A to each organization for administrative costs incurred. The amount remaining shall be distributed to each organization as soon as practical. If you're going to use, if you're going to deduct the administrative costs, wouldn't that obviate the need for a fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, I believe Section D in was envisioned for the time after an agent was involved, when the program had to stand on its own 2 feet. That's how administrative costs would be covered. As I understand the intent of the sponsor and the intent of Rasmussen Foundation in this in the lifetime of this bill through 2009, there would be no administrative fees deducted from the charitable donations.
Wouldn't you want to do that, though? So it's not a zero, so it does. So the cost of the program is assumed in the program.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, this arrangement was established by the sponsor with the Rasmussen Foundation, and again, ultimately, after the time they're willing to underwrite it, it would be a necessity. But for this period of time, they were happy to cover the cost, as I understand it.
Okay. Then I have two final questions, Mr. Chairman.
Last
page of the bill. If an organization disagrees, then there's a hearing process. Is that hearing process considered in the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, we have no idea the number of hearings we might encounter. This is a brand new business for us. I've estimated the cost for one or two hearings in the fiscal note, but that's about it.
Right.
That is going all the way through to the statewide hearing officer.
That'd be indeterminate anyway. Then I guess then finally in Section C, page 2, a list of organization is provided. And my kids get highlights for children, so we're always used to picking out the thing that doesn't belong in the group. And one of the things that didn't seem to belong in this group of kind of organizations is the one that says aid to the arts. Everything else is elderly, low income, emergency, health, mental illness. Now you've got arts. And so I'm sitting here thinking, aha. Just like we give all kinds of exemptions to those who go out of state and continue to receive a permanent fund dividend, we could start adding a Christmas tree to this, where you're giving to the, well, how about the Peace Corps, parks, low-income housing, schools, sports, veterans, on and on and on. Why aid to the arts among those sort of social, somewhat specific type group of entities?
Through the chair, Representative Weirach, my understanding of the inclusion, not specifically of the arts, but of a number of the organizations, was the Human Services Community Matching Grant monies were decreasing. I don't, and this would be a way to boost funding for certain of those organizations, but I'm not exactly sure why aid to the arts is included in there, or whether the Representative Seaton would care if that was struck. I think the community foundations, because they do have grants for the arts, and that's allowed under their in the community foundations, that that could cover the
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just said the fact that community foundations are included, this is a great idea, but arts groups can't apply to the community foundations for funding that would get a due or the amount checkoff from this, right? But you've added them in as a separate entity beyond. So that I was just curious why that was. Not that I want to do it. My sister's an artist, and you know I'll catch heck from all my friends who are artists. I just wondered what the intent is. I'm finished.
Okay. Representative Holm?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair to the sponsor, do you envision that the, we look at the fiscal note, do you envision that the all of the money that's going to cost to run the program would come from the Rasmussen Foundation as per their letter?
Through the chair, Representative Holm, there is a representative from the Rasmussen Foundation. That's my understanding, but I prefer if the Rasmussen Foundation could address that as well as the permanent fund.
Diane, would you like to come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Diane Kaplan, President of the Rasmussen Foundation. Foundation is prepared to cover the cost for the first 3 years of the program. And, we know there have been other attempts to have a bill like this, and they've generally not gone very far because of the cost to the state. So in the interest of promoting individual philanthropy in the state, the foundation's board has agreed to cover those costs for the first 3 years.
That's what I thought the letter said, so I just wanted to make sure it was on the record, Mr. Chairman. Additionally, I appreciate the fact that the Rasmussen Foundation is so interested. I'm just somewhat concerned as to whether or not, and maybe this is, comes to the sponsor or maybe even the senator, I'm concerned that that this that really does anything. I'm not sure that I understand why we can't do it today, why we can't give our monies today, and maybe we should conscript the oil companies to do so. I don't know, but maybe I'll leave that to another issue. But we apparently conscripted them already. But I'm concerned that we don't do it already. I mean, if in fact we are not providing for the services that we need, for example, the food bank and Fairbanks, I saw this one letter. They all live on the day-to-day, and I know that's true, but I'm concerned that we have a false hope that something's going to happen just because it sits on a dividend program. So I don't know how many people give their tax-free money on their dividend today. I mean, I suppose that'd be an interesting thing to find out from maybe Ms. Barton, how many people really check off anything as a gift to the university or whatever.
Through the chair, Representative Holm, we have looked at other states where there's an opportunity to do a donation to a nonprofit as a credit on your taxes, and there are about 25 or 30 states that allow individuals to do that, and a large part of it depends on the ability to promote the program to individuals. What we find in Alaska is that individual giving, particularly among the wealthier people in our state, is far below what it is in other states. The last statistics we have show that Alaska ranks 49th or 50th among the 50 states among in terms of the percentage of income given to charities by people who earn $100,000 or greater. And we have about three times the national average of people who earn $100,000 or greater in Alaska. So we feel that there's a lot of capacity to give, and it just may be that our citizens need a little more encouragement. Sometimes it just makes it easier, like the State Share campaign or United Way campaigns, for people to check off at the workplace or other opportunities, and this would be just one more opportunity to remind people that they have an opportunity to support organizations of their choice. So the estimates we have, or the hopes, is that it would draw somewhere around $3 to $5 million after the program is established. And for groups like the arts and for higher education, for the human services groups, that would be a very substantial amount in individual gifts.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just one observation after that statement. I think there also is another deterrent, and that's the high price of oil in my personal economy. I don't know what anybody else's is, but these days, you know, our cost of living here is so much higher than it is in a lot of other places as well. So the dispensable income, what we think it's dispensable income, is probably a factor as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the witness, for your testimony. There's no intent, nor is there any legal restriction in the bill, though, that limits this to the Rasmus Foundation. This is any community foundation in the state that that qualifies under law. For Fairbanks, Anchorage, Matsu, Nome, Juneau, Ketchikan, if they have community foundations that qualify under law, they would be organizations that could receive this money under the dividend checkoff. Isn't that correct? Is your understanding?
Through the chair, yeah, Representative Wire. The Rasmussen Foundation has no intention of being a recipient of any of these donations, but all of the community foundations around the state would be eligible, according to the bill.
Okay. Representative Schiff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Diane. The Rasmussen Foundation makes grant awards statewide and has for a long time. Based on where people check off, is that going to influence how the Rasmussen Foundation makes its future awards?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, on most grant reviews that the Rasmussen Foundation does, a major criterion is how much local support there is for the project. So we are almost never the largest, the only, or the first funder in a project. So if we don't see evidence of local support, we generally will not give a grant to that project. So we're hoping this will be a tool that local organizations can use to get board members and other supporters in the community to help them leverage funding from us and other funders in the state as well.
Okay. Representative Jewell.
Maybe this is more for Sharon Barton and for Diane, but in terms of that support, based on the checkoff of the person doing the donating, is there going to be a way to track that the contributions are in fact local, in addition to statewide? Well, for instance, Boys and Girls Club in Kotzebue. And you've got quite a few people in that area that make the donation, but on the scheme of things, on a statewide, it doesn't reflect that, because only local people are using that as not. Is that going to be able to be tracked so that people who look at that could say that there is in fact some local support, or does it make any difference where that support's coming from?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell. Any organization that is holds a designation from the IRS as an independent organization with a board would be eligible. And I'm not sure, for example, of the status of the Kotzebue Club, but I know, for example, the Nome Community Center that holds the Boys and Girls Club is a separate organization, and they would be eligible to be listed as an entity. Otherwise, it would probably be Boys and Girls Club of Alaska that would appear.
Well, I just thought you were in the wrong bill. We just heard about local support in HB 500, so I just
No.
Any other questions? Seeing that, Ms. Kaplan, thank you for your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions of this bill sponsor? Seeing none.
And I just have one.
Representative Stoltz.
I just wonder how they got a bill out of state affairs. No. Okay.
Would you like to comment?
No comment.
is there anybody from the public that would like to testify on House Bill 496? Nobody online? Now, seeing none, we'll close public testimony. I think we had an amendment here. Representative Grun Whiterock.
Ouch.
Hi, Representative Whiterock.
I move amendment number one.
I'll object to hear what amendment number one does.
Yeah, well, there's really three separate parts, and I am afraid I'm not done yet based on the testimony I've heard, but I wondered if I should talk with the sponsor before moving into this too much.
Would you like to hold this bill until
becomes
you have the opportunity to talk to the sponsor?
Yeah, I think I would.
Does the sponsor's staff have any problem with that?
No, sponsor's staff would be minimal.
Mr. Chairman, the reason is I want to talk about, I think this the contributions where you divide it both by dollars and percent is unduly cumbersome, and I think we should talk about that. And I also don't want to get too far afield of where this bill's already gone. I mean, if there's testimony and aids to the art, I don't really want to stand in the way of that. I'd like to get some more information on that. And then adding children in, that seemed to be logical because a lot of times children are left orphans in situations and they could qualify here. And there seems to be a reasonable basis for adding those in. And then also when somebody has opportunity to take somebody else's permanent fund dividend, like if they have a judgment, to add that last section in, I don't want them to be able to do the dues checkoff. It seems like they would fall in just above them, the public agency issue. But there may be testimony on that obviates the need for the amendment, and I'd just soon talk to the sponsor as opposed to take the committee's time.
Okay. With that, we'll hold House Bill 496 in committee. Representative Kelly.
Just a comment to the I had a little trouble warming up to this because I think we can, it's just going to keep getting added to and added to, as Representative Whiterock had said, and we'll be back here with this thing forever. But there's a couple of points, I guess. One, I'd like to thank Ms. Kaplan from Rasmussen, because that really added some credibility to the process, I think, when they come out. And the other point is, I guess, just is almost like a warning. As federal funds and state funds are pressed harder and harder, you can expect me to have the question in my kit that says, okay, here's a way you can go directly to 630,000 Alaskans. Show me how you're doing there. What are they saying about you? So you may find, we may find that this is a way to help us do what I think we do, as Ms. Kaplan said, far too little of is public philanthropy. We line up at the government here, and we haven't had anybody yet in hours and hours and days of testimony come in here and say they want us to cut government or that they didn't want something. So I guess I support it after thinking about it with some worries about it, but it is a way to go and tap that resource that is not responding as well as it might. And so I think I'd be supportive, and I just I guess want to mention that, but it's a two-edged thing.
Any other comments? Seeing none, we'll bring this bill back up after the after Representative Whiterock and Representative Seaton discuss it. That brings us to an end for today. Looks like our next meeting will be at 9 a.m. in the morning. On the agenda is House Bill 362, to increase to student-based allocation, and probably bills previously scheduled or heard. So with that, thank the committee for their time. Thank the public, and we're adjourned.
Okay, Louis, we'll talk.